Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Amid increasingly dire reports on climate change, extreme political dysfunction, and now rising fears of war in the Middle East, we talk to a scientist who studies resilience to find out what it is and how we can cultivate more. Among the many findings of his new national report, we here in the Northeast seem to be more resilient than other regions of the country. Today in The Exchange, resiliency. Let's get your thoughts into our conversation. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're spending the hour with Dr. Amit Sood. He joins us from Minnesota, where he's executive director of the Global Center for Resiliency and Well-Being. Dr. Sood also created the Mayo Clinic Resilient Mind Program and is working with health institutions, corporations, schools, universities around the country on similar programs. And Dr. Sood, a big welcome to you here on The Exchange. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Grateful and privileged to be with you, Laura, and your audience.
Well, there's so many buzzwords around this, Dr. Sood, and I wonder if you could just clarify for us, please, what you think resilience is versus other similar terms, mental toughness, grit, and so forth.
Oh, thank you. These all terms point in the same direction. The way I look at resilience is it's doing well when you shouldn't be doing well. There are so many definitions of resilience. The best way to understand resilience is through a story. So, for example, when I went to middle school here, the teachers were talking about children with disability who come to the school, focusing on their abilities. They come with a smile, give their best. They do not focus on what they lack. They focus on what they have. A patient of mine who, through significant adversity, actually practiced gratitude. And at one point, she was upset that she had to sell her home to pay for her medical bills. Later, she said, "I'm grateful I had a home to sell." Many people don't even have that. So this saying yes to life, focusing on having a can-do attitude, looking forward, looking up, that is what is resilience. And the best way to capture it is through stories.
So resiliency is doing well when you shouldn't be doing well. That's kind of a simple, neat definition. I like that, Dr. Sood. I wonder how you view resilience right now at a time of, you know, rising violence in our culture, attacks on racial and religious minorities, and all over the news, the threat of conflict with Iran. A lot of Americans say they're feeling pretty anxious. So as a resilience guru, Dr. Sood, how do you view resilience right now in this anxious time?
Yeah, I think it is best to have a zoomed out perspective. I'm sure if you were to have a newspaper 10,000 years ago, then there would be headlines like the rise of the mammoths and how the saber-toothed tigers are just going to eliminate our race. So every generation has had its own stressor, and we also have our own stressor at this point. So it is good to recognize that and recognize that, you know, if we are collectively strong, then we will be able to overcome these. Our goal is to hand a better world to our planet's children than the one we inherited. We intrinsically are action-oriented, relationship-centric, technology-fascinated, you know, species. So leveraging our strengths, recognizing that adversities have always been there, they will always be there, but we have to consistently work towards finding solutions. Having a long-term view, I think, can keep us going for a very long time.
One other question about just the concept of resilience in this time. We hear a lot, Dr. Sood, about climate resilience, but it's usually in reference to infrastructure like roads or water treatment or agricultural systems, not people. And I wonder what your thoughts are there on psychological climate resilience, on the idea of we humans living here on Earth maintaining resilience, even with reports indicating that our planet's own resiliency may be wearing down.
Yes, our planet is being tested, and I think we have a role to play in terms of we have had a role to play in terms of causing it, but even more importantly, we have a very, very significant role to play in reversing those changes. As I just mentioned, our primary responsibility is to hand a better world to our planet's children than the one we
Right.
inherited, right? So when we are personally stressed, we consume more resources. We know we eat more. We exercise less, and we actually spend just more resources that drains our planet. So our personal resilience and our the zoomed out perspective, looking at the long term, and going beyond the self and thinking about the collective is broadly the philosophy that's going to help the planet.
How surprising is it, Dr. Sood, that the World Health Organization has declared resilience a priority in its 2020 health campaign? When I think of the WHO, I think of, public health concerns like clean drinking water or malaria or something like that. I wonder what you think.
You know, it's not surprising at all. When you look at the impact of different determinants on our healthcare systems have only 10 to 20% impact on healthcare outcomes. The majority of the outcomes depend on social determinants of health, which is how much stress we feel, our lifestyle, our environment, etc. So 7 out of 10 of us have chronic illness, and the single most important predictor cause of chronic illness is chronic stress and poor lifestyle, lack of self-regulation. So when you look at 8 out of 10 out of us having excessive stress, 7 out of 10 having chronic illness, 5 out of 10 burnt out, 6 out of 10 feeling discriminated. This excessive stress has permeated our life and is impacting every single outcome downstream. And that is why I think stress is the number one epidemic globally at this point. And the challenge is it shows no signs of letting.
Well, it's interesting, and you mentioned some of the stressors that people face, and some of them are very real. And this does raise, Dr. Sood, a critique of resilience. Some commentators are saying, look, if we focus so much on individual resilience, we're getting the wider society off the hook for issues like systemic violence or racism or, lack of health care or lousy housing. And instead, we're saying to people, look, if you're not doing well, it's because you're not resilient, so shame on you. So can you tease that out for us, please?
Absolutely. So I think I completely understand that viewpoint. And the way I look at this is the bicycle model. So we have the personal resilience, and when we have the structural resilience. So we need both, just as you need both the wheels in a bicycle. So the stronger we get individually, the better the systems we will be able to build. And what comes first, egg or chicken? I mean, they both feed into each other. So the debate is and should not be, this versus that. The debate should be, how can we make our organizations, our systems more efficient, and how can we help the individual cope? So
That's
that's
really
one part.
interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, the second part is that instead of blaming the individual, it is best to validate the individual. About half of your resilience depends on your genes. And so nobody chooses to inherit, genes that predispose to low resilience. So instead of, half of your patience is actually related to genes. So when I am being patient, I just say I'm making good choices. But when I'm impatient, I say I have bad genes. So I think it is best to use science to help you rather than put you down.
That's really interesting. So, person, instead of saying, "Person, it's up to you to fix this all 100%," or "Come on, society, let's, not let people who are terribly ill not be able to pay for their health care," you're saying it's not one or the other. It's both. And when we're personally more
Exactly.
resilient, we can work on that structural change.
Exactly. So when you're driving, for example, you've been, yeah, there have been, I'm sure, instances where people have cut you across and you've felt annoyed and so on. So we now know that people who have low prefrontal dopamine tend to be a little bit less patient. So earlier, I would call a rash driver, a rash driver or rude, but now I say, oh, that's a guy with low prefrontal dopamine. So when you imagine resilience in this biological context, it validates people. Our entire work is about validating people, not judging them.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We're talking about resiliency today with Dr. Ahmed Soud, Executive Director of the Global Center for Resiliency and Well-Being. He created the Mayo Clinic's Resilient Mind Program, which is being used and implemented around the country. You can join us with your calls, questions, comments, your stories from your own life. Why do you think some people are more resilient than others? How resilient do you feel these days? What questions do you have about building resiliency in your own life? Again, you can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org or call 1-800-892-6477. You can comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. Again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Dr. Soud, another question about the link between resilience and physical health. You talked about stress and how it's related to chronic disease and how many people, not just in this country, but around the world, have chronic diseases. Give us a few examples that you'd like to cite that might make this clear for most people. You know, that clear link between stress, disease, and how resiliency plays a role.
Absolutely. There's at least three different links. The first is the biological link, where chronic stress is associated with lower heart rate variability, is associated with higher level of inflammation in our system, worse genetic expression, higher level of cortisol, higher level of norepinephrine, adrenaline. All of these are biological mediators eventually of inflammation, of chronic illness, predisposition to heart disease, and so on. So there is that clear biological link. The second link is when you're stressed, what do? You go in front of the refrigerator to eat that cookie or the pantry, right? So stress is associated with lack of self-regulation, which leads to excessive caloric intake, lack of exercise, and so on. And the third part is when you're stressed, you really do not seek healthy solutions. You know, our thinking is not as rational. We're not able to think deep and strong. And so in many different ways, both directly and indirectly, stress predisposes to chronic illness.
Wow. So I've read a lot recently about the role of inflammation in the body. And while it's good if you sort of sprain your ankle, it's a natural response. Having this constant level of inflammation in your body caused by stress can lead to all sorts of health problems, diabetes and, you know, mental health issues and so forth.
Absolutely. I think we need stress. So there's three flavors of stress, good, bad, and ugly. So, you know, after that old movie, and sometimes when I share this with medical students, they have no idea what I'm talking about, good, bad, and ugly. Because so we need good stress. A new baby in the house is good stress. A baby who is throwing a temper tantrum at the checkout line is bad stress. And a baby sick in the ICU is ugly stress. So we want our good stress. We want to convert bad into good stress and be prepared sometimes for ugly stress which life throws at us.
Again, our number on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your thoughts, questions, comments, and personal stories about resilience. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Soud, let's go to the phones. And Dill is calling from Amherst. Hi, Dill. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks so much for having this guest. It's a very important topic. I'm curious what your guest thinks about, you know, we have a president and people within the administration and the EPA and others who deny that climate change is even happening. They're refuting known facts that the large percentage of scientists around the world have accepted and are moving towards trying to deal with. And I'm wondering what effect the denial of facts, denial of science by official people at very high levels has on overall resilience and maybe ways that people and systems can combat that high-level resistance to facts and reality that are really kind of providing a really dangerous kind of reason why we need resilience. So hopefully I'm being clear here, but I'm just trying to get a sense of you know, in the face of climate deniers, how do we still be resilient and not doubt ourselves and doubt our, you know, the rest of the system that seems to be cooperating with, you know, reality and known facts.
Dill, thank you so much for the call. And certainly the reports about climate, you know, are eating away at a lot of people's resilience, I'm thinking. Go ahead, Dr. Soud.
You know, there's something called, thanks, Jill, something called selective quoting of literature. Basically, when you go to Google, and if you want to find a research study that supports your contention, you'll be able to find it. So, I mean, if you want to correlate, you know, how puppies smile in Zambia with cholesterol level in middle-aged men in U.S., I'm sure you'll be able to find a study there. But the reality is, I think we should take the leash of science and just follow the science wherever it takes us, you know, in a completely open-minded way. That is our calling. So I think approaching this from a scientific perspective, which validates what you are saying, your contention as well as concern, is perhaps the most, I think, is the most mature and the most resilient way to approach this.
Well, I think Dill would agree with you. I think his question was, in the face of people, you know, not following the science and taking decisions that oppose what the scientific consensus says, it seems like Dill feels stressed out by that, and he's wondering how he can be resilient in the face of that.
Yeah, I think one thing that I've realized is that I really personally cannot, as they say, boil the ocean, but I can make a difference in my own microenvironment. So you as an individual in your family, in your neighborhood, and as a change agent in your community, you can be the strong voice for what you believe in. And if we all stood up and raised that strong voice, it will create a national movement and an international movement, which it already is doing, which will change how people look at climate change and other such challenges.
How much is consumption of media connected to resiliency, Dr. Sood?
In general, as you know, Laura, like in one study, when people were asked what kind of news they like to watch, and those people who said we would like to watch positive news were shown the news, and they, even those people were selectively watching negative news. Hmm. So media consumption correlates with higher level of anxiety, higher risk of post-traumatic stress disorder, greater depression, overall lower resilience. And it is partly because media portrays a little bit of more negative news, and partly because we feel negative news is more actionable, and so we pay more attention to it.
People tell me they're stressed out by the news, quote unquote. But they also, and so sometimes I'll say, well, take a break from the news. And they'll say, no, no, I need to know what's going on. So how would you respond to that? I hear this a lot from folks.
Yeah, two things. One is focus more on local news rather than national news. Local news tends to be proportionately more positive and more actionable. We feel like what is happening, you know, 10,000 miles away will make a difference in our life. It will a little bit, but what's happening in our neighborhood is more important, I think. So that's one. Two is I refuse to be put down or negatively affected by negative news. I use that the more negativity I see in the world, the more positivity I want to create in my own micro world. So I often share that when I look at the national news, I usually do to recognize who should I be praying for today, who should be in my prayers, because you know the news is so much full of negativity. But on the whole, I think we will go past this tough phase. There will always be challenges, but there is never a reason to let go of hope.
Well, Dr. Sood, lots more to talk about after a short break, and we'll get into some of the results of the recent study that you co-authored, and of course, all the work that you've been doing about people building resilience in their own lives. So lots more to dig into in just a moment, and you can join us with a call like Dill did, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. More on resilience in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today, resilience. From Silicon Valley to local schools, there was lots of discussion about this concept last year. And this year, the attention to resilience continues, with the World Health Organization making it a top priority for 2020. Today, we're examining a new national study on resilience, and we've been hearing from you. Join us with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can comment on Facebook. You can tweet us. One more time, that email is exchange at nhpr.org. Our guest is Dr. Amit Sood. He joins us from Minnesota, where he's executive director of the Global Center for Resiliency and Well-Being. He also created the Mayo Clinic Resilient Mind Program and is working with health institutions, schools, universities, corporations around the country on similar programs. And Dr. Sood, a couple more questions for you, and then we'll go back to our listeners. How much is resiliency linked to income? Because it does seem like it'd be easier to be resilient if you can at least pay for your doctor's visits and your car repairs and your heating bills.
Absolutely. And I think there's a broad relationship between, going from abject poverty or, have nots to have somes. But when you go from have some to have lot, the delta is small, very much like happiness. And this partly relates to beyond a certain threshold, generally you have to work much, much harder to raise any more money, to earn any more money, and which overall impacts your quality of life and well-being. So there is a correlation up to a certain threshold beyond which actually trying to earn more money could be hurtful.
That's interesting. And on the flip side, we heard from a caller who couldn't stay on, wondering about so-called helicopter parents and whether they have reduced the resiliency capacity of the next generation. We hear a lot about this, helicopter parents, snowplow parents, tiger moms. What do you think, Dr. Sood?
Yeah, we raise our children these days like they're swimming in the kiddie pool while they have to go into the rapids when it comes to life. I had this feeling because I was actually in a rapid river, and that is exactly the thought I had. Oh my gosh, that's what we are doing. And I recently was talking to a medical student, and he had remediation in anatomy, and he said, this is the first time I've ever failed in life at age 25, so I don't know how to handle failure. I think it is very important for us to handle failure, for us to have our children have a deep sense of self-worth, but at the same time, be okay with being vulnerable, be okay with being wrong, be okay with getting negative feedback. And I think a balanced approach there is good. We do not have to be perfect parents. I think a good parenting style I like is good enough parenting, where you're not hovering over them all the time. One thing I heard was my mom really took care of me. I mean, she was the umbrella. She really never let any shadow, any rain come on me, but she was my worst enemy because she never let me grow.
So good enough is actually perhaps, Dr. Sood, better because people learn how to deal with, the rain and the shadows.
Exactly. I sometimes see, oh my gosh, my child only had 24% protein during, in this lunch. that doesn't help, because then you are basically feeding your anxiety and your own view of the world on the child and your own ambitions sometimes. I think it's good to have a zoomed out, balanced view. Let them struggle a little bit. That's how immune system develops. If we have zero infection, our immune system will not develop. So we do need a little bit of infections, a little bit of injuries, a little bit of falls to be strong.
That's interesting, because we often hear that, little kids get sick a lot because they just don't have an immune system, and they're just going to get sick so that they build up that immune system. It sounds like you're making an analogy to personal resilience, Dr. Sood. Same thing.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Actually, if you really want to know what is right in life, just follow the immune system. Immune system was a big deal before antibiotics came. So anger, hatred, envy, they all hurt our immune system and make it pro-inflammatory. Compassion, love, connection, volunteering, they all enhance our immune system to fight external agents and decrease internal inflammation. If you want to do it right, just follow the immune system. It'll tell you. And the second thing second very useful biological marker is genetic expression. Again, anger, hatred, envy, all of these cause pro-inflammatory genetic expression, while love, connection, friendship, volunteering cause anti-inflammatory genetic expression.
Here's an email from Vin that came in. He says, as a coach, one of my mantras with my teams has been, nothing rattles us. We will let the weather or anything that might go wrong affect our opponents. We will still be the best in confronting any challenge. One of my rowers called me a decade after his graduation to tell me he had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Nothing rattles us, he said as we ended the call. After fighting the disease for 5 years and still living life with energy and eagerness, he called me this fall to say that he was going into hospice care. This was a very emotional call for me. He calmly said, nothing rattles us. Through all this, he has been an inspiration to me, applying that mantra of resilience in ways I never imagined. He has now been my coach in how to take on challenges in living and in dying. And wow, Vin, I'm getting choked up reading this story. I really appreciate you sending it. And I saw something just on your website this morning, Dr. Sood, about, you know, the value of mantras. I mean, some people might think it sounds a little, you know, out there, but talk about that if you could.
You know, I think when we are in the throes of adversity, I think it is very good to have a concrete path in your brain where to go. I recently actually had a motor vehicle accident. It was a head-on collision.
Oh, wow.
My car was totaled and that gentleman's car was totaled. And one of the first thoughts I had personally, I'm sorry, I'm gloating here, is he okay? Mm. So thankfully, I came out without injury. And the poor fellow, you know, he was having panic attack at that time, almost, you know, as it looked. So this whole focus, this whole other centricity, focus on compassion. When you have that pathway well carved out in your brain, then you're able to negotiate adversity much better. So, you know, organizations, companies where people care for each other tend to withstand adversity much, much better compared to those where everybody is just focused on the self. And that applies to countries, states, you know, everywhere. So having these mantras provides you a well thought out ideas that resonate with your values that you can get back to when you are in the state of, you know, dire need. Just one more thought there. When your brain is filled with a lot of adrenaline, then you're not able to think rationally. I mean, think about the last time you were getting late and you couldn't find the car keys right in front of you. They were right in front of you, but you couldn't see them. And my wife picks it up and gives it to me, and she calls it male pattern blindness sometimes. I suffer from it.
So you talked about compassion and how that's helpful. It seems, though, Dr. Sood, that the popular culture does not emphasize compassion. A lot of a lot of what you see on social media and traditional media is more about dissing the other guy. It's about us versus them. It's about why I'm right and you're wrong. There's a lot of name calling. There's a lot of sort of shaming on social media. I mean, the popular culture does not seem to be in sync with compassion right now. It seems to be encouraging us to be more aggressive.
Which is perhaps one of the reasons why we have so much stress. I think if life, here's how I see it. If life were a pizza, then gratitude is the toppings while compassion is the base of the pizza. You know who suffers when we are not compassionate towards each other? Our babies, our little ones. You know, we are a species where our newborns come so vulnerable that no single individual can take care of the newborn. It takes a collective, collaboration of forces to raise this child to be an adult, right? And so we have no choice but to be compassionate towards each other. I know that your child and my child will be connecting with each other at some point. And when I'm being compassionate towards you, I'm really thinking about how do you and I together raise collectively our planet's children to give them a good world? So we have no choice but to be compassionate because our newborn are so vulnerable and we need to collaborate with each other. And I've personally not met any employee who was compassionate yet incompetent. Sometimes we confuse compassion for weakness or we think it's a cliche. Compassion is about love. It's about caring. It's about honoring the other person. It is about, of course, being compassionate to yourself at the same time.
Again, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Vin, thank you very much for that moving story. Again, the email, exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we talk about resilience. We'd like your thoughts on how resilient you're feeling these days, how you build resilience in your own life, and why you think some people seem more resilient than others. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. I want to talk, Dr. Sood, please, about the results of your study that you co-authored recently, and then your thoughts on building resilience in the individual's life. But what were people's perceptions when you did this study on resilience? How resilient did Americans say that they were?
So that is a very interesting question. So when you ask people a broad general question of how resilient you are, we have this optimism bias. Vast majority, 70-80% say, yes, I'm very resilient. Very much like when you ask drivers, are they in the top 50%? 80% say they are amongst the best drivers. Like, but when you really break it down and look at the reality, you realize that they're actually not as resilient as they think they are. So there's a disconnect. We overestimate our overall resilience, but when it comes to challenge, facing a challenge, we sometimes do not perform as well.
That's interesting. Why do you suppose that's the case?
I think it is partly because we think about resilience as dealing with very difficult situations, a new diagnosis, a motor vehicle accident, etc. But, you know, keep in mind those difficult, really difficult situations happen only occasionally, thankfully, to us. Resilience is more about maintaining your patience through an inching traffic with a full bladder, you know. It is about, holding your thought while someone else is speaking, even though you know that this person is probably not making sense and you know more about this topic. So resilience is about those little things where you have to exercise self-control. You have to, you know, feeling grateful for a sore throat or an episode of back pain, and I've had both, obviously. So it is those little daily things beyond, you know, for which we do not have very good psychological immune system. Resilience is about that in daily life.
Very interesting. And the study you did is based on a big survey of Americans. What can you tell us, Dr. Sood, about resilience in different cultures? For example, there's the famous British stiff upper lip culture. Are Brits more resilient, or are people in other cultures more resilient than Americans?
In general, there have been only a few studies that have looked broadly at different cultures. In general, I would say societies that expose its members to early adversity that they are able to overcome are likely to be more resilient. Everybody has the potential to be resilient. There isn't any systematic differences as far as I know in terms of the genetic vulnerabilities, just that what you get exposed to. So, for example, society with lower amount of resources, they tend to have happier adults. Actually, for happiness in adults, you need early childhood adversity. If you have zero adversity, you actually tend to be a very miserable adult. So there's a whole, excessive adversity doesn't help, very little doesn't help, but modest amount of adversity. So many of your listeners may have experienced when they go to a country that is much poorer, they find people so much, they're very welcoming, they have a smile on their face, they have hope, they have an upbeat attitude, and they are collective. And that's the other part. One of the core aspects of resilience is our connection with each other, our relationships. And when we lack resources and when we have external challenges, we tend and befriend, we connect with each other, which makes us more resilient, and it also makes us happier.
Very interesting. And I got two more questions just on what you said, Dr. Sood, but I want to go back to our listeners. And Pam is joining us from Dover. Hi, Pam. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks, Pam.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you so much. And thank you, Dr. Sood. What a wonderful topic. I'd like to add humor and support groups and the power of touch. Yesterday, someone told me about a wonderful comic strip, the Charles Schulz created. Charlie Brown is sitting on one side of the room, and Snoopy is sitting on the other side of the room. And Charlie Brown says, "You only live once." And Snoopy says, "No, you only die once, but you live every day." And I thought that was such a wonderful comic strip. And, you know, finding Calvin and Hobbes or Pogo, you know, who said, you know, "I found the enemy and he is us." So not laughing at other people, but laughing at our own humanity and laughing at ourselves. I had a minister also once who said that the hugs that he gave to the elderly after the service on Sunday might be the only hug that those people got all week. How important the power of touch is, and also asking for help. It's so hard to ask for help, and especially for guys, but to find support groups and to create families and support if we don't have families that support us, how important it is. And that's not an easy thing to do. But
Pam,
all of those
yeah.
things have helped me be resilient.
I really appreciate the call. And picking up on what you said, Pam, and I'm going to throw this to you, Dr. Sood, what differences do you see among men and women in terms of resilience? Pam mentioned that she perceives guys don't ask for help. That is sort of a cultural image that we have, fair or not. What do you think?
So from a neuroscience perspective, and thanks, Pam, and I'll come to your point in a second. From a neuroscience perspective, women have more active limbic circuitry. So they tend to be more predisposed to mood disorders, anxiety, stress, and such. Worry, of course. And of course, they feel more directly connected with raising children. So, you know, you have as many hearts as you have people who you love. So if you have, you know, two children and a spouse, you have got one heart within you and three hearts beating outside your body that you want to protect and take care of. And that is going to create stress. The interesting part is that they also respond better to intervention. So their system circuitry is active and it responds quickly. So there is the reason for hope there. They are both uniquely resilient in their own specific way. The question I often ask is not if you are resilient, but how are you resilient? Because everybody is resilient in their own unique way. When it comes to humor, I mean, Pam is so right. If you don't laugh at yourself, someone else will for sure. So might as well laugh at yourself. I think humor is about connection. Hearts that laugh together beat together. So the three things that you pointed out, humor, support group, and touch, all three point to connection. Even we know in NBA, early on in the play, the teams that touch together each other much more tend to be actually scoring higher and winning, have higher chances of winning later.
Wow, that's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. Sood, I'm going to cut you off there for just a second. But when we come back, we'll talk more about creating more resilience in your own life, building it back up if it's been torn down. I know you have lots of ideas there. So we'll come back to that in just a moment. And you can keep joining us. Pam, thanks for that call. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Join us by email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment.
Franklin Savings Bank has been a supporter of New Hampshire Public Radio for many, many years.
Don Beers is head of marketing for Franklin Savings Bank and a proud NHPR underwriter.
For us, it was important to attract those who choose to live, work, and play in the communities that we serve.
Learn more about how to connect with NHPR's community-minded audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow, does exercise slow down the aging process? We'll find out more live tomorrow morning at 9 on The Exchange. This hour, a new study on resiliency in America and what this concept means, how to build it in your own life. We've been hearing from you. Join us with your thoughts. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or call 1-800-892-6477. Our guest joins us from Minnesota, Dr. Amit Sood, Executive Director of the Global Center for Resiliency and Well-Being. He created the Mayo Clinic Resilient Mind Program, and he is bringing that to other institutions in healthcare, business, schools, universities around the country. One more time, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Dr. Sood, we got an email from Keith in Nottingham who says, can you talk more about increasing resilience with children? Our daughter's teachers have talked to us about her issues with resilience since she was in preschool. When she has a conflict with her peers that don't result in her getting what she wants, she will often end up sitting by herself and crying. She is now in elementary school. She is very social with other children and is involved in sports. Do you have some suggestions as to what we could do as parents to help her increase her resilience? And I'm guessing a lot of listeners have a similar question, Keith. So thank you very much. Go ahead, Dr. Sood.
Thank you. Yeah, so there's two parts to resilience when it comes to children and including adults too. One is the outside in, the other is inside out. So the outside in resilience is what you learn from others. So helping children, one of the best ways to do is to be a good role model for them, parents and teachers in particular. A child needs one loving, kind adult to be resilient. And that's what is the gist of research on pediatric resilience. And they depend a lot on the world outside them. So the more you can be grateful, the more you can be compassionate, the more you can be present, the more you can live with values and authenticity. And I think those are the things that they will observe and embody. The second part is inside-out resilience, where helping them cultivate these through structured ideas, such as, so I have a program we're working on, which entails helping children learn deep, slow breathing, along with having strong attention, focus, and cultivating a resilient mindset that is driven by the values of gratitude and compassion. I think that is the second part of it. And the third part of it is physical resilience, which is helping them eat healthy, making sure they exercise, making sure they have good sleep hygiene. So those are the three parts of helping children become more resilient. We are actually working on something what we call happy genius, where this is a combination of cognitive and emotional skills to help children become more resilient, which is, I think, sorely needed in the world that is today.
Well, and Keith, I'll direct you and other listeners to our website where we've got some links to Dr. Sood's work. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Check out the web post for today for some more information and some fun links. You can do a test of your own resiliency as well. Get some thoughts and advice from Dr. Sood and his team. It's nhpr.org/exchange. Jane from Londonderry recommends the NAACP publication called The Crisis Magazine, which seeks to educate and challenge readers about issues facing African Americans and other communities of color. Many of their stories feature discussions of resiliency. And I wonder what you think about this, Dr. Sood. I'm really glad you wrote, Jane, because your study did look at resiliency among different demographic groups.
So the question is, does demographics impact resilience? Mm-hmm. And I think it basically goes back to the same, the core idea that experiencing adversity at an early age that you're able to overcome and the sense of connection you find in your community are what correlates with resilience. So that is the main energy behind many of the variables that impact resilience. So yes, I mean, the study did find that, African Americans ranked the highest when it comes to resilience, and Asian Americans were the lowest. And we can definitely speculate on the reasons with whites, Hispanics, and American Indians in between. So there is some correlation, but I think it basically boils down to people's ability to absorb stress, experience stress, and convert that into a strength factor and connection in the community.
This is really interesting. And we've done whole shows, Dr. Sood, on early childhood trauma and some concern here in New Hampshire that with a drug addiction epidemic and, you know, parents just not being around for their kids and kids coming home to parents who've overdosed. And, you know, we've heard from a lot of people about trauma and its impact on that developing brain. And I think if there's too much trauma, the fear is the brain does not develop properly and it's in that constant fight or flight mode. So we hear worries here in New Hampshire that a generation of kids who have not been properly cared for will not do so well. So I'm just wondering, you know, it sounds like you're saying you need some early adversity to know you can overcome it, but too much can have some serious consequences too.
Yeah, just as, you know, I like my coffee a little bitter, a little sweet. You know, if my coffee is just all bitter, then, I mean, I can drink a little bit of it, but I would like a little bit of sweet element there too. So that is balance. And so the relationship between trauma and resilience follows an inverted U curve. And the same thing is with strength and stress and performance, arousal and performance. So zero adversity leads to lower resilience, lower happiness, while overwhelming adversity also leads to lower resilience. We need some adversity for sure. And that is very individual sometimes. Best not to judge people, because people who decompensate with less adversity probably have vulnerable genotype. It's not their fault, right? And we also change based on the days. I mean, the day you walk in with a bad infection, and if you've thrown out your back and you got yelled at by somebody, your resilience is going to be low compared to other days when you're feeling on top of the game. So it is best to be kind to others and kind to yourself, but recognize that the adversity today is likely to make me strong tomorrow.
A lot of your work, as we've said, is helping people improve their resistance, and you're taking this Mayo Clinic program around the country, and you've talked, Dr. Sood, about humor, exercise, healthy food, compassion, finding support groups. What's the low-hanging fruit that someone listening today could pluck, Dr. Sood? You know, what's the sort of one thing that most of us could pretty easily do to improve our resilience right now?
So there's a couple. One is for the simple daily things, ask yourself, will it matter in 5 years? Flat tire, spilled milk on dining table, et cetera, et cetera. If it won't matter in 5 years, it's not worth your time today. So that's the lowest hanging fruit. For intermediate adversities, I try to remember, I've personally seen two people who are alive today because they missed their flight. They were very upset when they missed their flight, only to realize 2 hours later that it ended up saving their life. So remember that there are times when adversities prevent catastrophes. And that's how you embrace adversities. I think that is the lowest hanging fruit. And I think the third part is, if you're not sure who deserves your compassion, then recognize it's you who deserves the most compassion of yourself. I've never met anyone who said, I'm appreciated way too much here. I mean, that's my problem. Most people struggle with being appreciated, and most people struggle with self-worth.
Let's go back to our callers. And Jeff is in Concord. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. My question for the doctor is, that email from the guy in Nottingham was perfect, and the show is so topical. I have a 10-year-old daughter, and last night I was talking with my wife about this, because the older she gets, the more we're realizing that we worked so hard to create a caring, loving environment for her, where we always supported her, and worked so hard to make sure that she was protected, and I never saw myself as a helicopter parent. We let her deal with her problems, but we worked to make sure she was in a loving world and she was the loving person. As she's getting older and she's moving further and further away from us and having to deal with conflicts on her own, we're realizing that she is not very well equipped, and she just shuts down. I mean, if it comes up against opposition, she is not equipped to deal with these conflicts. And I feel that we have failed in not preparing her for dealing with difficult situations. And my question for the doctor is, you know, you talk about a loving, caring, supporting role model, which we've provided, but can you go too far so that these kids don't know how to deal with bullies or conflicts amongst their peers?
Jeff, great question. And give yourself a little compassion, too, that, you know, there's no such thing as a perfect parent. So you can let yourself off the hook there. Go ahead, Dr. Sue. This is a really interesting call. And Jeff, it's so good to hear from you.
Thank you, Jeff. And I think about this every single day. We have two daughters, age 15 and 9. So you and I are very much in the same, you know, should I discipline at this moment or should I be kind at this moment? And what I have personally decided is an experiment in kindness, while at the same time trying to empower them and have healthy self-worth, yet be challenged. No, I don't think you have, you sound so wise and so anchored in values that I think you have done the right thing. And recognize that she's 10, her brain is still young. It is still 15 years away from full maturity. She's going through transition. So she will learn. This is a phase of life where she's definitely vulnerable. But I think if you challenge her little by little, particularly give her early success in some challenges. For example, if she has social anxiety, expose her a little bit and help her grow. And then that success feeds into the next. I think that is a way to build that. Resilience is a skill. We can totally build it. And I think, you can certainly follow the literature. Recognize, though, that 50% of it is genetic. So she is, there's a lot to happen in the next 15 years as her brain matures. The key is for her to have strong attention and a resilient mindset where she can reframe quickly using gratitude and compassion. And I anchoring her in a hopeful construct, perhaps faith anchored or otherwise, is likely to help too.
Well, and again, like I did with Keith, I'll direct you to the website, nhpr.org/exchange, Jeff, for a little more information there. So, Dr. Sood, you talked about the huge importance in terms of building resilience of human connection. Some analysts now are blaming our digital devices for pulling us away from face-to-face physical human interaction, disconnecting us from the here and now. Other people say, no, that's too easy. You know, some of the problems we see in our culture are deeper than that, you know, income inequality, violence, and so forth. What do you think? Can we point to the digital devices, or is that too simple? Is it something deeper than that?
I think it's both. So we have been hunter-gatherers. So we used to hunt and gather food. Now we hunt and gather information. So these digital devices provide us access to novel information day in and day out, and we crave novelty. In one study, people will rather give themselves painful electric shock than sit alone and get bored. So we need new, novel, interesting information, and that is what these digital devices give us access to. These are like super normal stimuli. So these devices are designed to be addicting, and we are also vulnerable to that kind of addiction. They have become our surrogate body part. So we have to treat them as addictive, very much as we treat tobacco and other agents of addiction. Even the presence of a phone that is shut off on the dining table disrupts the quality of conversation. And people, in Silicon Valley are not saying, let's devise, apps or devices that do not engage people. They really want your eyeballs and advertisements and so on. So I think it is up to us to make sure these gadgets do not become surrogate body parts, because the risk is that if I've got 1,000 followers on social media, I don't need to hug my mom. And that's a huge loss.
I did want to mention that the survey we've been talking about was undertaken by Everyday Health, partnering with Ohio State University. And you'll find information to the surveys and all sorts of other important links and ideas on our web post today. Again, it's nhpr.org/exchange. Dr. Sue, let's take one more call. Catherine is calling in from Sutton. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. What a fabulous show. My question for you is, what do you think of the creative arts and creative writing as a tool for resilience or engagement, empowerment? And how do we acknowledge that amazing works of art have been created under conditions of extreme stress?
Wow. Catherine, thank you so much. Go ahead, Dr. Sood.
Yeah, every major advance on the planet, including creative work, has happened because somebody was able to have deep, sustained attention, either externally or internally. So creative arts, creative writing reflects our ability to deploy deep and sustained attention, which is one of the core pillars of resilience. The three pillars of resilience are awareness of how our brain operates and depletes resilience. The second pillar is attention. And the third pillar is attitude or mindset. And this applies to both children and adults. So creative arts, creative writing reflects both the second and the third pillar, deep attention and a can-do mindset, where I will convert my personal trauma into something that is inspiring for others. So yes, they are reflections of resilience, and observing them and being inspired by them makes us more resilient.
Last question for you, Dr. Sood. What has doing this work on resilience meant for you personally?
Oh, I'm stuck. So the other day I was getting out of the elevator. It was a tough day. One of my colleagues said, "How are you doing, Amit?" And I said, "Oh," then he started laughing at me and he said, "You are stuck, right? Because you're researching this, you're teaching this. You just can never tell that you are stressed out, because if you're stressed out, then it's not working for you." So no, I think I feel very fortunate to be to have the privilege of helping others and to earn people's trust. And I feel committed to living life with values that I share with others, which has been a tremendous gift, because we all are vulnerable. Every single day while I'm driving on a highway, I've got a crazy thought that comes into my head which doesn't belong in my head. And I'll still be embarrassed if my thoughts were live cast on a billboard. But it has been much better in the last 10 years of work than it would have been otherwise. So I'm grateful.
Well, and as you told us, that's the element of resilience is gratitude. Dr. Sood, I have to wrap it up there. I really do apologize, but I'm going to direct everyone again to the website, nhpr.org/exchange. And Dr. Sood, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Laura.
That's Dr. Amit Sood, Executive Director of the Global Center for Resiliency and Well-Being and creator of the Mayo Clinic Resilient Mind Program. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.